Again to the Ask Petey Show. And isn't that the truth, that we certainly all go through so many ups and downs in our lives? And God knows there is nobody that is immune, regardless of the fact if you're rich or poor or black or white or gay or straight or trans. And what I'm trying to express to you every single week is that we do not need to navigate this landscape on our own. And whether or not you are dealing with depression, in fact, I was looking at some of the statistics in this country, 350 million people, adults in the United States, are suffering from clinical depression. And if you're looking at anxiety, old anxiety, new anxiety, 40 million Americans are suffering from anxiety. And the very, very best thing that we can all do when we're finding that we are really on a roller coaster ride that never seems to end is to definitely reach out and ask for help. And if you're looking at substance abuse issues, and that includes prescription medication, including all the antidepressants and all the psychiatric medications that, in my opinion, are so overly prescribed in this country. And what about the opioid addiction issue that we are dealing with, or really not dealing with, in this country? Or perhaps you are just finding that you are drinking too much or popping too many pills. I know that I have a couple of patients right now who've been working with psychiatrists for a number of years, and I have been trying without success up to this point to get them to change doctors. One patient is on four different sleeping medications every single night. She takes 13 different pills every single day for a variety of, in quotes, psychiatric issues. And at this point, she still refuses to get a second opinion. Or what about sexual problems? And for those of you who may know, we are not doing well in this country when it comes to sex. In fact, there was a landmark study at Western Pittsburgh Psychiatric Hospital with 100 couples who defined their marriages as either happy or very, very happy. And guess what the results were of their sexual behaviors in this in these marriages? Well, for women, 50% of the women had difficulty becoming aroused. An additional 35% of women had difficulty having orgasms. And 15% of these happy and very happily married women were unable to experience orgasms under any circumstances at all. And what about the men? Well, a third of the men had issues with premature ejaculation. And listen to this statistic. 52% of men between the ages of 40 and 70 had problems with erectile dysfunction. Of course, these days, you know, men will go to their doctor, and instead of having a really thorough physical to figure out what is it that is going on or not going on physiologically, psychologically, that is causing erectile dysfunction. Of course, most men, they leave with a prescription, and there are so many other things that need to be looked at, including blood flow issues, heart issues, cardiac problems. So that, again, there are a lot of issues that we are all experiencing, and you don't need to navigate this life journey on your own. It is way too stressful, and we're living in very, very crazy times. And therapy does not need to mean that you are going to be engaged in therapy for, your entire life. But if you're just finding that things are not going well, that you are not enjoying life in the way that you would like to enjoy it, getting a second opinion is always a really, really good idea. Athletes do, performers do, and I think that we all need to really give ourselves permission. It is not a failure. It is not a weakness to reach out and ask for help. And of course, relationship problems. Again, in this country, we're also not doing very well in the world of relationships. People are always surprised, you know, when I cite the statistics. The divorce rate for first marriages, 48%. The divorce rate for second marriages in the United States, 62%. And the divorce rate for third marriages in the United States, 73%. And of course, there are a lot of reasons for that. And I talk about that, of course, all the time. And just in summary, I mean, this is what I found with my work over the past 35 years, is that if each of us is not in a good place, emotionally, psychologically, psychiatrically, if we haven't dealt with our, in quotes, unfinished business as best as we can, even though we can't change history, we're not going to be in the moment. We're not going to be in a good place to be able to make a good decision about relationships. And number two, and what I have found also, is that the majority of people, there's a learning curve here, and that we all really need to become students and learn about the ingredients that go into healthy relationships. And where do we learn about healthy relationships if we haven't been fortunate enough in our own family of origin? We certainly don't learn anything about healthy relationships in schools. And you look at the media and you look at the nonsense and the pathological relationships that we watch on television, I think people are really, they're left to their own devices to make some of the most important decisions of their own. And this is why I've always felt that relationship education is so important. And I mean, I believe that it should really begin at the kindergarten level, where kids are really being taught about what healthy relationships are, what unhealthy relationships are, so that they have a jump start. It's not just about math and science and social studies, and these are all important, and reading and writing. But again, if we're looking at how well we're doing socially and emotionally and psychiatrically and relationally, we have a long way to go. So the other thing that I just wanted to mention, I was doing some research over the weekend about six conditions that actually feel like clinical depression but aren't. So, for example, if most people went to their primary physician and they complained of symptoms of fatigue and guilt and worthlessness and irritability and insomnia and decreased appetite, loss of interest in regular activities, persistent sadness, probably he or she would leave the office with a diagnosis of major depression and may very well be prescribed a Zoloft or a Prozac, etc. However, you have to understand that these very same symptoms belong to a variety of other conditions, physical conditions that require treatment other than antidepressants. You know, as an example, vitamin D deficiency, hypothyroidism, low blood sugar, dehydration. So again, you know, when it comes to really getting to the root of the problem, I think what happens typically is that people are looking for the quick fix. And in our medical community, I mean, how much time do you actually spend with your doctor? I mean, people tell me they'll go in and they're lucky if they see the doctor for 10 or 15 minutes. So that we as consumers, I think that we have to become, you know, better advocates for ourselves and make sure that we're really asking for what we want, so that we are going to be able to get the best kind of medical treatment. We're going to be able to have the best kinds of relationships in our social lives, in our professional lives, and asking for what we want and giving ourselves permission to ask for what we want in all contexts of our lives really go a very, very long way. Just a couple of other things, because I have two amazing guests and I really want to spend the majority of the show in talking with my guests. There are a number of things that we actually know that can improve the quality of our lives every single day, including plant-based diets. There was such an interesting article that I found over the weekend about people in Okinawa. They live longer than almost anyone on the earth. And it was like, okay, what are these people actually doing? Well, their diet, and they themselves said that it was the diet. Of course, there was socialization, and they were out in the, you know, in their beautiful areas where there wasn't the pollution that we have here in the United States. But that the diets that they consume, sweet potatoes, green leafy or yellow root vegetables, tofu, bitter melon, modest amounts of seafood, and it's amazing. It's overall a low calorie, high carbohydrate, mainly due to the sweet potatoes. And most of the people in Okinawa are living close to 100, so that there's something really important that we can take away from that. And of course, you know, other things like exercise and eliminating toxins, including toxic people from your life, positive visualization, dancing, listening to music, herbal teas, massage, acupuncture, really treating yourself well and eliminating things like sugar and soda and alcohol and nicotine. And also what I find, and I think a lot of the studies will certainly bear this out, minimizing the social media and the cell phones and the computers, and really looking to find a balance between work and fun. Well, before I introduce my guests, I want to play one of my favorite songs, I Am Woman by Helen Reddy, and that is going to set the scene for what I know is going to be a very, very interesting and important discussion. I Am Woman. Well, my two guests, Carol Gilligan. Oh my. If we could probably spend the entire time talking about what you've done and what you continue to do. Carol is an American feminist, ethicist, psychologist, best known for her work on ethical community and ethical relationships and certain subject-object problems in ethics. She's a professor at New York University and a visiting professor at the University of Cambridge. She is teaching as a visiting professor at NYU, Abu Dhabi. She is best known for her 1982 work in A Different Voice. And her work has been credited with inspiring the passage of the 1994 Gender Equity in Education Act. And in 1996, and I was really interested in reading about this, Carol Time Magazine listed her among America's 25 most influential people. And she is the founder of Ethics of Care. Oh, my God. And, of course, is the co-author with Naomi Snyder. And, Naomi, welcome to you. So you were a former, or maybe still are, a human rights lawyer.
Former.
And she is currently a research fellow at NYU, co-founder of NYU's Radical Listening Project, and a candidate in psychoanalytic training at the William Allison White Institute. So here we are to talk about your new book, Why Does Patriarchy Persist? And I have to tell you, I posted on Facebook, and I can't even begin to tell you the response from people, you know, who are listening and who I encourage to actually call in. And the number is 888-874-4888. So, first of all, I think we should really define what is it that you two mean by patriarchy.
Oh, well, thank you, Beatty. It's just a pleasure to be here with you.
It's great to have you here, too.
And I love the song.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Patriarchy, we have a very straightforward understanding of what it is. It's a way of living, whether it's in a family or a religion or a institution or government, where there's a gender binary that's based on a gender binary. Things are either masculine or feminine. You know, like real men don't eat quiche. So quiche is feminine. Mm-hmm. And the color pink is for girls, not for boys. And certain kinds of cars are feminine cars.
Is that not changing, though, for heaven's sakes?
That's why does patriarchy persist?
Yeah.
I mean, of
yeah.
course it's changing. I mean, because we contrast patriarchy. So patriarchy is based on a gender binary and hierarchy that privileges, divides things into either the masculine or feminine, and then privileges the masculine. And all you have to do is listen to our president. He's strong, masculine, not weak, feminine. He's the winner, not the loser. Whatever he says is true because he says it. I mean, that's patriarchy. The opposite of patriarchy is democracy, which is based on equal voice, which is what we mm-hmm. believe in.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Everybody has a voice, and we're all humans.
So, okay, but why do you think, I mean, we're making some movement. In fact, I was, you know, looking at what's going on, of course, in Congress now. So we have 6 women who are running for president. We have 102 women who will be serving in the incoming House of Representatives. I mean, we're moving along, and yet I'm wondering, you know, why do you feel that it is still persisting, you know, despite the strength? And I really am curious to hear what both of you have to say about the Me Too movement and the impact that that movement is having on us and Time's Up and looking at issues like toxic masculinity. I mean, why do you think that this is continuing to persist?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really the question of the book,
right?
that's the million-dollar question, and that was the question that we really wanted to understand. Like, we, similar to what you're saying, like we clearly saw the massive strides that were being made towards greater equality and greater sort of democracy, but at the same time, and it's often subtle and it's insidious because it's so subtle. We saw the persistence of patriarchy. And I think it's interesting to know where this began, because it began with a course that Carol teaches at NYU Law School.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 things to say about that. One is just that, so I was a student in Carol's class. And this is a class full of, you know, like, we're not kind of 1950s housewives. We're not like submissive, quiet
right.
women. We're at NYU Law School. We're
right.
women with opinions and ambitions. Mm-hmm. And yet, reading Carol's work, I think it resonated with all of us, even though in a different voice is 30 years old. Her work on girls is 20 years old at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it resonated with, and it's running on boys' experience as well, but the men and women in that class of really seeing the persistence of patriarchy is still alive and well, and why. And one of the things that we thought when we were writing the book was we were like, well, the biggest issue that we're going to have is people are going to say, patriarchy? Are you for real? Like, come on, it's over. And then, I mean, the timing was crazy. This book came out at like the election of Donald Trump. And suddenly, I mean, you just needed to look at the debates between Clinton and Trump and to see the way that she was treated in the media. It was suddenly
disgusting.
So,
it was just disgusting.
And it was suddenly so clear. Yes, there are massive strides towards greater equality, but there's a forceful patriarchal backlash. And, I mean, was it 51% of white married women voted?
53%.
So it's, and that's also what we wanted to understand, is why does it persist? Why are so many of us complicit in a system that actually we think is harmful to everyone, to men and women?
Mm-hmm. And so what were your discoveries? When I was reading the book, which I absolutely loved, and I understand that there are 3 discoveries that the two of you have made. So let's talk about what you discovered.
Well, I think Naomi has to start, because
all right,
this whole book and the discoveries began with a paper she wrote for the seminar, which is called Resisting Injustice, that I teach with David Richards
mm-hmm.
at the NYU Law School. And I'm a psychologist and he's a lawyer. And we ask, what are the wellsprings? What lead people to resist injustice
mm-hmm.
in any form? And you know, what suppresses a voice of resistance. Mm-hmm. So that's what we were talking about. Naomi, this is your story.
So, well, it's really our story because it was reading Carol's 2001 book.
2002.
Yeah. In A Birth of Pleasure. Mm-hmm. And it's the first book that Carol talks about, in her work, talks about patriarchy. And she looks at the tension in that book between patriarchy, which, you know, she's just described to as this kind of gender hierarchy and binary, and she contrasts it with democracy. And she kind of, by looking at kind of quite personal stories of people in therapy and couples therapy, looking at young women, looking at the father of young sons, kind of charts how the initiation into patriarchy requires a sacrifice of love, of authentic connection. And the reverse is also true, that love is the way out of patriarchy. Forming kind of authentic connections across these boundaries is a way of undoing them.
That both people, that men and women, agree consciously, unconsciously, that love is going to seal the deal.
Yeah. Right. Love is the path towards democracy.
Right.
And the book really resonated for me. And then at the same time, I had this question, well, why? If love is the way out, why do we sacrifice love for patriarchy? And as I was pondering this question, my thoughts kept going back to the death of my father. So I was about 5 years old when my father died. Mm-hmm. And I learned really firsthand from that experience that kind of the way to avoid further loss was to take yourself out of relationships, to kind of adapt yourself to whoever wanted to, like, how to however the other person wanted you to be, just to make sure they wouldn't leave you again. And so I saw, like, I kind of know firsthand why it is we sacrifice love. We do it as a defense against further loss. So that was kind of the question I posed. Does patriarchy, in requiring a sacrifice of love for the sake of hierarchy, does it in some way serve a sort of a similar sort of defensive function?
Let me ask you something, you know, putting on my therapist hat here. I mean, in some way, did you blame yourself for your father's death?
I think unconsciously so, uh-huh, yeah. And uh-huh. I think in a way that, like, you can kind of see the parallels between that and, like, some of the kind of the way women respond to kind of some of the abuses endemic in within patriarchy is that there can be a tendency to blame oneself as a kind of a way of dealing with that loss. But I don't want to preempt the discoveries too much, but one of the things that we discovered is that is not the inevitable response to abuse. The first response is always to protest it. Mm-hmm. It's not to blame yourself. It's to, if someone does you harm, it's to blame the other. Mm-hmm. It's only when that protest is subverted that we quote Fairbairn in the book, mm-hmm. which is, it's better to believe that you're a sinner in a world ruled by God than an angel in the world ruled by the devil. That at a certain point when the possibility of protest is completely kind of lost, when the hope of kind of living in a just and fair world fades, that's the point at which you start to distort your perceptions of reality and to blame yourself rather than the abuser.
And would you not think that that would be a great beginning point for a child or an adult, anybody at any age, to reach out and get some good help to clarify some of this as early on as possible so that the confusion and the false beliefs, mm-hmm. Which end up hurting us a lot, would not persist?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think one of the strongest findings, and it is what underlies our discoveries, is that children, in fact, naturally left to themselves, do protest. I mean, mm-hmm. they don't immediately go into false beliefs, but that the protest, it depends on how the protest is met.
Right, exactly, Exactly, exactly.
And unfortunately, there's a long history even with kind of not just within the family, but within services that were supposed to help people of the victims being disbelieved. Mm-hmm, so I think it requires some thought in terms of how we as a society, and particularly as therapists, like how we respond to people that come into our consulting rooms.
And of course, so many people early on, they don't consult with anybody.
Yeah.
You know, they keep it inside. I mean, I was looking at an article, actually, that my husband, Jim, showed me last night in preparation for, you know, today's discussion, you know, finally seeing Andrea.
Oh, I saw this. Yeah, yeah, that people are now kind of. Yeah.
Yes. And, I mean, clearly, I mean, when she talks about, you know, patriarchy, when she talks about that all sex is rape. I mean, this is a woman, you know, who was raped at age 9 mm-hmm. when she was in a movie theater mm-hmm. And then had subsequent multiple rapes over her lifetime. And you can understand why she got to a place where she, you know, mm-hmm. she believed that all sex is rape. I mean, that was her experience, of course. And I was thinking, wasn't it a shame that she probably didn't get any good help? And lived her life out. I don't know whether she did or she didn't. But I mean,
I don't know either.
Yes.
But we begin our book with two stories of, one is a law student, his name is Adam, and one is a sociology graduate student, and her name is Jackie. And she was a college student at a very leading college, I mean, mm-hmm. and brilliant and, you know, flourishing. And in her senior year at college, she was raped by a classmate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, by a classmate. And there's no question. I mean, he acknowledged that he raped
right,
her.
Right.
And she was told, basically, you know, did she want to prevent him from graduating?
Right.
Did
she said no.
So she yeah. was told, basically, that, you know, did she want to ruin his life? She should say nothing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then finally, when she went to the police, and she had a whole drawful in the police station mm-hmm. in the town where this college is, of women who had similarly been raped or abused, and where nothing had come of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just within the individual. I mean, the person who goes, after all,
exactly.
Jackie went
yes.
to the college administration,
yes.
and then she went to the police.
Yes.
And she was told, you know, did she want to ruin his life and so forth? There was no question she'd mm-hmm. been raped, but she had no history of rape or abuse.
Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully, you know, that too is changing. I mean, look at all the, in quotes, powerful men, you know, whose downfall, you know, occurred as a result of very, very brave women.
Well, but
you
have to
out.
Think that Me Too, I mean, Trump's inauguration is followed by the Women's March, which was the largest march ever.
Right.
And that's, what, 2016?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's followed by Me Too, which, you know, I think about Me Too as women leaving patriarchy, because
right.
we say in our book, patriarchy depends, it's maintained by women's silence.
Yes, yes.
And by men's violence
exactly.
or threat of violence.
Exactly.
And so when a woman speaks out, in the past, other women would sort of stand back to watch to see what happened
mm-hmm,
to her.
Mm-hmm.
And for women to come forward and say, you know, I'm hearing what you're talking about, your experience, that happened to me too.
Mm-hmm.
So women speaking out and not being left alone or shamed or abandoned or told they're not good women, but being joined by other women, I mean, that's the end. That's women leaving patriarchy.
Exactly. And it's been such a powerful, powerful movement. I mean, I and one of the shows, I was, you know, going through all of the different men, you know, who have been ousted. Thank God.
Kind of terrifying.
Well,
but
very, very terrifying.
Petey, you have to yeah. say, we have a president who boasted of grabbing
Absolutely.
Women by the pussy.
Absolutely.
And he has not been ousted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, hopefully there are going to be some ways to oust him. I mean, my God.
No, but I'm
God.
Just saying, but
yes,
I think you
exactly.
have to, you, it, it's
have to recognize both.
You have to recognize both of these
yes.
things. So we
mm-hmm.
would say this fight right now between democracy and patriarchy, we're living in the middle of it.
Right, exactly.
Both sides are out in the open.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, for sure. For sure. I mean, I was just astounded, you know, when the results came in and that 53% of white women voted for this in quotes, pussy, this mm-hmm. tyrant, this disgusting human being. It's how you wonder.
Well, what do you want to say about those women?
I want to say that they need a lot of education to figure out, you know, is this the kind of a human being that we want, you know, as president of the United States?
Well, but they wanted him.
They sure did.
Because they voted for him. I mean,
right.
So, I mean, it's on that level that led us to write this book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is to understand what on the face of it, because we would agree with you, on the face of it, it makes no sense.
Right. It makes no sense.
It really makes no sense. But if you're a psychologist, you have to say there's a psychological logic driving this.
Mm-hmm.
Because people don't do things for no reason.
No, exactly.
And I mean, I think without listening to these women, I would be very reluctant to say, what is it that they're doing something that makes sense to them? Mm-hmm. I always love it when, you know, years ago when I used to teach developmental psychology and I would teach the work of Freud and Piaget and so forth. And Piaget was fascinated by the children's wrong answers. And he made this very simple observation that to the child who gives the wrong answer to a question, mm-hmm. to the child, that answer is right.
Right.
So for the women who voted for Trump, after he said, I grab women by the pussies and all of the things that you were talking about, to them it somehow made sense. So we said that was our question. Why does patriarchy? What was the logic according to which this makes mm-hmm. sense?
Well, I mean, one might wonder whether or not these 53% of women, you know,
white women, not women of color.
Yes, that's true. Came from backgrounds where this was just something that was business as usual. I mean, I've treated hundreds and hundreds of women who were sexually abused as children. And most of it began in their own families of origin. And when they met somebody who abused them as, you know, later on in their adolescence or adult life, the women told me it didn't feel wrong. It sort of felt familiar. It was familiar. They hadn't been able to get the help to work it through. And
but
that
what about
was,
the black women? Because they were abused, too. And they didn't vote for Trump.
Well, they were a lot wiser than the 53% of white women.
These are the kinds of questions that's why we wrote our book, is what I'm saying.
And mm-hmm. I think, but also like a point, important thing to just kind of reemphasize is that the book begins kind of with this observation that there is this innate capacity for resistance. Mm-hmm. So what happens to that? Like, say you have this hypothesis that these women grew up in kind of abusive households where patriarchy was just business as usual. Right. But in the same way that, like, when a child knows that they're being neglected, they cry. As infants, we know when right. something's wrong.
Right.
So for patriarchy to persist, for abusive systems to kind of perpetuate itself, something needs to happen to that kind of innate desire for love, democracy, for relationships that are responsive. So that's kind of what our book looks at. What happens to that capacity for resistance?
Let's talk about our three discoveries.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So our first discovery was that what John Bowlby, who was really an expert on, I mean, he was a psychologist who observed how young children responded to loss.
Mm-hmm.
Like a child who had to go to hospital. And in those days, parents couldn't go with a child. And he said there was a pattern. That first there was, as Naomi said, there was protest. Mm-hmm. The child protested the separation from the mother or the caretaker, whoever.
Right.
And when the protest was ineffective, then you saw the child move into despair, a kind of listlessness, mm-hmm. and finally into detachment, where the child would prefer, for example, objects rather than people because mm-hmm. they could mm-hmm. control it. And we noticed our first discovery is observing girls at the time of adolescence when they are initiated into what it means to be a good woman in patriarchy, which is to be selfless and care for other people, and observing boys around the ages of 4 and 5 and 6 when they learn what they have to do to be perceived as a real boy or one of the boys, not girly or gay.
Mm-hmm.
that we saw, they followed the same trajectory that Bowlby described. The first thing was protest. And then when the protest was ineffective, despair and detachment.
Mm-hmm.
Because little boys, for example, there's much higher rates of signs of depression among young boys than among girls. And it only changes at adolescence.
Right.
So our first discovery was that the trajectory Bowlby describes as the response to loss was the response of children to the initiation into patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
They were responding to a loss of what Naomi was talking about, the human desire to live in connection with oneself and other people.
Mm-hmm.
That was our first mm-hmm. discovery. Our second discovery was that what are held up in patriarchy is the ideals of manhood and womanhood. For a man to stand on his own two feet, to not need anyone to take care of him, to be self-sufficient, to be autonomous and in control, and for a woman to be caregiving and responsive to other people, you know,
selfless.
Like an angel, selfless,
right,
are identified by Bowlby as pathological responses to loss,
right,
meaning ways of responding to loss that almost guarantee that you will not be able to make relationships again.
Mm-hmm.
The response actually stands in the way. So that was our second discovery.
Let me just ask you something. Do you both feel that early intervention and early education, tackling and discussing all of these issues would really help?
No question.
To
no
transform question,
we did.
The trajectory.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
No,
absolutely.
Because and would do join. You see, we say just like the healthy body resists infection,
mm-hmm.
the healthy psyche resists these.
Right.
I mean, the healthy psyche protests and resists, you know, moving into despair and detachment.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in our research, the research I did at Harvard, the Harvard Project, with girls and with boys, in fact, I did exactly what you talked about. I organized women teaching girls, girls teaching
mm-hmm,
women
mm-hmm.
to at just this time or
right.
strengthening healthy resistance and courage in girls. That
right.
was another project of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, company of women, company of girls. And then I organized groups of fathers of 4 and 5 year old boys and
mm-hmm.
said, you know, what is it that you see in your little boy that you hope he never loses? And it was those human qualities that were at risk.
Right.
So that was our second finding. And our third finding was, you want to say it? It was that's the one
yeah.
that really blew our minds.
The third discovery was the most surprising and I think the most kind of significant. It was that patriarchy persists because it subverts this capacity for protest and repair. It shames that kind of resisting voice. So in girls, it sounds kind of like angry, bitchy, bossy, kind
mm-hmm.
of not what a good woman does. And for boys,
mm-hmm.
kind of to resist the breaking connections, kind of to be girlyish and to be not a man. So that kind of in that way, patriarchy ensures this movement from protest to despair and then detachment by shaming that capacity for protest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, normally as humans, when we lose connection with ourselves or others, our move is to repair, to
right.
find the other person again
right,
or
right.
to find ourselves again. And patriarchy shames that move to repair
mm-hmm.
so that their loss becomes irreparable.
So this is why, I mean, from what I'm gathering and what I've certainly found in my own work, that relationship education is key.
Absolutely.
I mean, this could transform everything.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And this is what we were able to do in the Montreal schools in 1975. Wow. That was it. And, you know, I was reading a piece a couple days ago. Barack Obama talks about toxic masculinity in being a man. And all of these kinds of issues need to be discussed early on within the educational school system. And as far as I know, in the United States, I don't know about the private schools, none of this goes on.
Well, there's, you know, it's interesting that you speak about Canada because there's a wonderful Roots of Empathy project in Canada,
uh-huh.
you know, that was organized by Mary Gordon that is spread throughout Canada,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is, as she says, you can't, what is it that empathy can't be taught, it can be What's her phrase?
Modeled.
And the people, they bring a baby into a classroom.
Right.
They teach relationships.
Right.
And her project, The Roots of Empathy, is in some American schools, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that we don't know. I mean, what you're right is, the fact is we know how to prevent this.
We do, exactly. Mm-hmm. That is exactly right. I mean, that was...
She says empathy can't be taught, it can be caught.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, it exists. We don't need to teach people how to do it. We just need to cultivate it.
And it can be modeled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is where, you know, I would think that if there was some movement to be able to design, I mean, there's probably many good programs that would be able to be implemented into schools, beginning at the kindergarten or the first grade level.
The interesting thing is they have been. And it's like they get implemented, and you're absolutely right. They all work.
Sure.
And then?
They're cut. The budgets are cut, right?
That's right.
Not important. Mm-hmm.
No.
You know, everything else is important.
They threaten the structures of hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a much more dynamic thing. It's not that we don't know how to do it. We do know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can multiply the examples of brilliant programs that have been in American schools as well as Canadian schools. You could go out right now and you could find many schools where these programs exist and are having exactly the effect you'd. And then you suddenly look around and that it's teach to the test. And what are they cutting? They're cutting the arts programs.
Exactly.
And they're cutting. And then you have to say, how come? Mm-hmm. And then you have to say, what investment? That this is really a conflict that when you start to move toward a fuller realization of democracy. I mean, you mentioned Obama. We had an African-American man as president in the 60s, in the time of Martin Luther King. That was that would have been a dream.
Right.
And it happened. And we had a woman who ran for president and won the popular vote by 3 million
mm-hmm,
votes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So as you move closer to realizing more fully the values of democracy, you also get patriarchy reasserting itself. Mm-hmm. And we have Donald Trump as president, who is unapologetically patriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he says, which is the patriarchal thing, it's true because I say it's true, because mm-hmm. I'm the father, because I'm the winner, because I'm the patriarch. Make your point about resistance. I think that's a great point.
Yes.
So it was really fascinating in
the State of the Union.
Yeah, the State of the Union address. You know, many people commented on the fact that Donald Trump was really promoting this idea of like cooperation and you know, people pointing out how hypocritical that is.
Right.
But there was something even kind of more pernicious in what he did. He listed like among all of the kind of bad things that we need to be avoiding, like revenge and I can't remember. He listed resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And he contrasted resistance and cooperation. And really, that's the patriarchal view of resistance. Resistance is a threat to authority. From a democratic perspective, resistance is crucial to sustaining connection. The only way you can be in touch with someone is if the other person is going to be honest about how they feel, tell you, hey, that's not fair. That didn't feel good. That's the mm-hmm. only way.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a kind of fascinating
And Naomi wrote an op-ed that got published.
Mm-hmm. Do you not think also that, you know, young little girls, mm-hmm. okay, have to be, of course, boys have to be taught as well. I mean, we all have to be taught. How to deal with anger and how to deal with injustices and how to deal with protest so that we're not internalizing all of these feelings and that we're being given permission, if not by our parents, then by somebody, maybe a teacher, maybe a guidance counselor. I mean, I used to do role plays with the kids in the groups. Okay, this is the situation. What are you going to do? How are you going to express your feelings? You're hurt. You're angry. You're upset. So that it's an exercise. It's kind of like tennis. I mean, I'm a tennis champion. I mean, you have to do the drills. You got to keep at it all the time so that you're on top of your game and you know what to do.
You know, I think it's interesting because we write so much nowadays about toxic masculinity. We're so kind of aware, and it's great, of all the ways that masculinity harms boys. I don't think there's, I mean, I haven't seen the phrase toxic femininity being looked at, like, of how these ideas of, like, female selflessness, of goodness, of not saying what you, that's toxic
it's
for women.
It's toxic, absolutely.
It's, you know, and so I don't think it's, like, our point is women don't need to be taught how to get angry, how to, it's that needs to be cultivated, that angry voice needs to kind of be heard as something valuable and not as something threatening. I have it even now. My friend will annoy me and I will really struggle to tell them because there's a part of me that says, oh, I don't want to hurt them. And we need to teach women, girls, that expressing kind of what you really think is a positive thing.
And I mean, the way I see it is that, again, unless it is taught, and if it's not being taught, you know, in one's home, there has to be another venue. Otherwise, this is going to persist.
Yep.
And that's, I mean, that's a little scary. I mean, Barack Obama, he gave a talk, and I just love some of the things that he said. The talk was on toxic masculinity, and he says the notion that somehow defining yourself as a man is dependent on are you able to put somebody else down, able to dominate. That's an old view, he added. So, you know, hearing from Obama, one hopes, of course, he was talking to a group of African-American young men. And it was cute. He introduced himself. I don't know whether you heard about that.
As Michelle's
husband. And I mean, so on both ends of the spectrum, I mean, there is a lot of, I think, concrete work teaching that has to happen. Otherwise, I don't see how there's going to be any real instrumental change. I mean, do you agree?
Well, I would only say that they are taught that to be a man means to dominate. That's not a natural assumption. I mean, boys don't start out thinking that I have to dominate someone in order to be a man. I mean, what's you call it being called toxic masculinity is patriarchal masculinity, which is where being a man means not being a woman or like a woman, too emotional, too sensitive, too whatever, and also where it means being the superior, the dominant, not the inferior, where everyone's divided into the superior or the inferior. That's what's taught. So you could say if that's taught, then you have to counter it.
Right.
Obama is countering something that these boys were taught that he sees as toxic for them. And he's absolutely right. And Naomi was saying, girls are taught that if you say, well, I'll quote one of the girls in our study. This is a girl who was the valedictorian of her high school class and got into every single college she applied to, top colleges. She said, if I were to say what I was really feeling and thinking, no one would want to be with me. My voice would be too loud.
Was that her belief?
No, it was her experience. She got straight A's in school. She was extremely popular. She was one of the she was a very attractive girl. And her experience was, if she said what she really thought about the poem, it would be the wrong way to look at the poem. If she told people, I'll give you a quote, that, I mean, because this is the kind of remark, and it's not coming out of, I don't know what you think, but in the novel Jane Eyre, you know, by Charlotte Bronte. So Jane Eyre is 10 at the beginning of the novel, and her Aunt Reed says to her, she calls her a liar. So Jane Eyre says, if I were a you say I'm a liar, I'm not. If I were a liar, I would say that I love you, and I don't. So in other words, now I'm interested right now because that voice is among the women in Congress.
Yes.
People say to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, your Green New Deal is this. And she said, if you're going to talk to me about my Green New Deal, you have to read it first. So women are not intimidated, and they stick to their, and they say, if you really want to engage with me, okay, but then I'll tell you what I think.
And that's, I think that that's the message that, you know, educators, that we have to give women, mm-hmm. that it is okay to say what you mean and mean what you say, and there may be consequences. And are you up to dealing with the consequences of communicating your truth?
Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I think it's interesting that the point that Carol just made about that was her experience in terms of how these lessons are taught, because I don't think it's like boys are literally told to be a man, you must do. I mean, some might be, but I think more often than not, these things are taught in the way we relate to each other. Mm-hmm. So very often, kind of, girls are being taught this thing, not in terms of literally being told, don't say that, but if they say that, being respond, like how they're responded to. So I think as women, and like say older women responding to younger women, we have to really reflect on our own kind of tendency maybe to want to quieten certain voices in women, or to kind of not respond positively when we hear those voices, because implicitly then we're teaching a message that says whatever else we're saying on the surface, if we're not responding to that voice with kind of respect, then the message we're teaching is shut that voice up.
Well, you know, I see in my practice and very educated and quote successful women who aren't sure. And they'll come in and they'll say, you know, so-and-so talked to me like this. I'm not sure if it was really abusive or not. I'm not really sure if he meant what he said. And I'm not really sure how I should be responding, you know. And I'll say, well, hey, that was a really abusive kind of a conversation you had. And you got to give yourself permission to let him know that enough is enough and don't ever talk to me mm-hmm. like that. Oh, really? Well, I've been with other people and they sort of talk the same way and I really wasn't sure and I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to, you know, express that feeling. You know, giving people permission to say enough is enough. Now, you may lose this lousy relationship, but at least you're learning that your truth and your experience is authentic and important.
Yeah. And based on Carol's work, I've sort of... One thing that Carol did in her interview with girls and women was to question that surface narrative that says, I don't really know.
Uh-huh,
and when you
uh-huh,
question that
yeah,
narrative,
yeah.
often what you find is
they
do know.
They know.
And you're by questioning it,
right.
you're giving them permission
right.
to say.
Exactly.
I'm going to forget the example, but yeah, it's powerful once you question that surface narrative. There's a lot more going on.
I mean, I have this is early on in my research, and I was asking women to solve these moral problems that psychologists ask, you know, that uh-huh, they tell a uh-huh. little story, and what do you think this person should do? And a woman looked at me and said, would you like to know what I think, or would you like to know what I really think?
Uh-huh. Yes, yes,
meaning
yes.
Meaning she had learned to think about morality in a way that was different from how she really
right.
thought. And she was aware of the difference.
Yes. And I think, you know, it's such a wonderful thing if we get to a place in our life where we're able to say, hey, to hell with the consequences. I need to be true to myself. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to engage in any abusive, you know, relationships of any kind, whether it's a small A or whether or not it's a capital A. Mm-hmm. And I think that so much.
But, you know, I think my sympathy is. There are women who get stoned to death for that,
mm-hmm.
who
yes,
really get killed.
Yes, that's
and
true.
Women who
yes.
lose everything when mm-hmm. they do that. So, I mean, I think it's not just, you have to say, you have to also deal with how have we created a society where mm-hmm. for someone to say what they feel and think
can
yeah. really be dangerous yeah. for them.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm looking at the clock, you two. I don't even know where this hour is. I have so many
quick.
More questions, discussions. Listen, I want to thank you both so much for coming. There's so much more to talk about, and it's true. When you talk about this, one has to look globally. It's not just the United
yeah.
States. It's not just, you know, middle class, you know, people, you know, here in New York City. Carol Gilligan, Naomi Snyder, Why Does Patriarchy Persist? It is a must read. It is a must read for all of us, for men, for women, for adolescents. you two, you've done really an amazing job. You really have. And I'm so glad that we were able to do this. I mean, you know, we've talked here and there, but I mean, this was great. This was really great. And people can buy the book on Amazon.
On Amazon, yeah.
On Amazon, again, you know, Why Does Patriarchy Persist? And listen, I wish both of you, you know, so much, you know, luck. I hope you sell millions of copies. we all need. I mean, this is not just, you know, a book that you, you know, just kind of look at. You read it. You got to take it all in, and hopefully that there's going to be, you know, a lot of impact for women, you know, and for men. So
thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. And listen, as ever, I want to thank all of you.